Accession number 26864, Reel 12.
Arthur Caney, Reel 12. So the buffalo was taken back.
So they ate this food, but they ate so much that I went round to see them, obviously to see if they had plenty of food, and they had eaten so much that they were so swollen that their skin was shiny, blown up. Oh, they were in pain where they'd eaten all this food. But they were very happy, of course. So in the Christmas afternoon, we said we'd go for a walk. So I had a Beretta rifle, which I hadn't seen before, one of theirs, Italian one. And my friend, he had one, and we had two escorts. So we're walking through the bush, and suddenly somebody shouted out, which I now know was Kafago. I didn't know what it was then. I'd only been there a few weeks. What they said was in Swahili was rhino. Now, there's this rush coming towards us, and I'm looking round, and there's two trees. They're up the tree, and I couldn't get out of the tree. Now, people will tell you, what I'm going to tell you now, experts will tell you it doesn't happen. Well, it did. The rhino was coming straight for me, as close as that fireplace is now, where I pressed the trigger. And I couldn't see, I thought I could aim at their eyes, but it's too quick. But you can't see a rhino's eye because it's on the side. So I aimed at the side where I thought the eye was. Now, fortunately, I wouldn't be here today if it hadn't. As soon as I pressed the trigger, it slapped onto its face. I heard the smash and the noise. And the rhino stopped and turned to the right and went to the bush. If it hadn't, I wouldn't be here today, I don't know, because I couldn't have jumped out of the way in time. Then we had to call the game wardens to try and find it, because it could have been wounded. But I think what it was, the rifle was too small. It wasn't the proper rifle for it. In any case, I didn't expect to find a rhino.
So what was the daily regimental life like? I mean, was it exactly the same as any other British regiment, as it were?
Well, because we were in the operational, you see, and each company had their platoons forward in different areas. Sometimes we sent them from the headquarters, but generally speaking, they were in a camp in the forest. And I would go and see them regularly, at least once a week I would see each company separately. So not only would I go up to see if they wanted anything, I'd just go up and, well, it was all social as well. I mean, it was a bit of fun, it was good from my point of view, and I would take up any stores they wanted. And a wonderful life with them.
What were the particular problems for a quartermaster there? I mean, were the things that were difficult to get?
Well, now look, we were in Mount Kenya. Now that's 3.5 miles from Nairobi, 3.5 hours on a fast truck. I used to leave the camp at 3 o'clock in the morning to get to the camp at the Kahawa, which was the big stores place. And it took me a week to train them. Because when I got there, they say, well, we've just come in, we must have some coffee, see? So I used to get niggly then, because I was in a position where they were in peacetime conditions, and we, as African troops, were operational. And here's me leaving at 3 o'clock in the morning, and it took me at least a week to get them trained. And then they were running around, it was wonderful. Because we had a very, very smart dress, we had bush hats on. And once they saw my bush hat on, that time in the morning, they would do anything, but it took them some time to realise that Nairobi was peacetime, and in the forest it was operational.
Was there any things that were difficult to get? I mean, were there shortages that caused any problems?
Well, no. Not like during the war, no, not like with the British troops now. No, we could do. It's a very interesting what I'm about to tell you. Yeah. Anyway, they were around all over the Mount Kenya, and I would visit them, and it was a day out. And I would take whatever was up there and go up with the sailors sometimes or on my own. But they were always, when I got there, there was usually only one European, or maybe a company commander and a sergeant major, European, the rest were Africans. But they were all so happy, all so cheerful, on their own, of course, as well. But being of a happy nature, the Africans, they were good to serve with. And they would do anything for you. Sometimes I would have to take food up for them. Occasionally, during operations, we would collect, or somebody would collect, about 120 kikuyu from the villages. Now, those people could be Maumau or not Maumau. And I never forget one night, I had to take up 120 kikuyu with rations, packs, and I had a sergeant major only, so I was at the front and he was at the back. And we were going through the forest at the midnight at night. I thought to myself, well, if they wanted to run at any time they could, or if the Maumau attacked, we couldn't do anything about it. Anyway, it was very interesting going in the forest at night like that, because there were no landmarks in the forest, and I was lucky to find the company I was trying to find, because I heard somebody snoring. There was a sentry snoring, so I was able to find, deviate from the track, and that's the time I stayed with them that night. And somehow or other, they were all in small bivouacs, and the elephant came through. Now the elephant walked through, stepping over these wild elephants, stepping over these small tents. Didn't touch, nowhere near the troops. I think that, it's wonderful, isn't it, when you think of wild animals walking over, not rushing through and putting a foot on anyone.
Did the Africans then show respect for their landscape? Because, I mean, there was an awful lot of, you know, the big game hunting and the tourism has affected everything, hasn't it? But did they show respect for the wild game and so on?
No, that was food.
Right.
Oh, no, food. It was tricky there. The rhinos that through the forest, you see. The forest, there was the plateaus, and then the forest, and then the bamboo forest, which is above that, which then goes on to the plain above, which is almost on the slopes. At different stages, the troops would be in various areas. But the animals were there. And if quite a few, some of the Kenya regiment, Liz Campbell's husband, he was the CO of the Kenya regiment, and they were, some of them, two of those I think were put in hospital or killed by rhino in the bamboo tunnels. They couldn't jump out because of the bamboo. Well, it's tricky there.
Yeah. So any other stories associated with Kenya? How long were you there? Or
Kenya? It was a long time. Kenya, yes. We used to go fishing at Christmas time, or another Christmas. I had another Christmas there, and went up, and the CO wanted me to produce trout for Christmas lunch. Most of those families had gone home, so the CO and the signal officer, they were both honorary game wardens because they'd been in the country before. So they were honorary game wardens. So they went out with me, they took me out fishing, but they didn't want to fish the way they knew I was going to fish. They wanted trout. Now you can't, to catch trout easily, you use a worm. Well, that's against the rules, of course. So all they did, they walked away, and I finished up catching trout. I caught 22.
With worms.
But of course that's because nobody else was fishing on Mount Kenya there. We went near the Royal Lodge. Remember the lodge where 1952, I think, was the Queen? She became Queen there, didn't she? 1952. Royal Lodge, Rigati. Lovely, wonderful place. And we were all around operational, all around that area.
Yeah. What evidence did you see personally of the Mau Mau? Were there any incidents where you saw evidence?
Well, on the farm, a friend, the adjutant's wife, was in a farm, I told you, but they moved to another farm. Now, this farm had a very, very thick hedge around it, so thick you couldn't get through it, fortunately. Now, she was on her own now, and she had a pistol and so on, but they used to attack the farm. They were attacking them in those times. And one of her houseboys had been killed by the Mau Mau and thrown over the hedge. So she threw it back. She threw the pieces back, chopped up and thrown back. And she was also firing in the dining room through the roof at them. They had telephone, they had wireless communications, so they could call for help. But it's a bit too late if they had the roof. But they had some guts, those people. But there were stories of, just before we arrived, about the time I arrived, in the early days of Mau Mau, where the forest people, people working in the forest, there was an Italian family. The Mau Mau had caught them, and thought one girl had been saved by hiding in the roof. But the others, they'd been all chopped up. And they chopped up the pregnant women, you know, slit them open. And they're not very good at all. I've seen animals chopped, you know, the cows, chopped the legs, slashed the legs. And there's animals running, had to be shot, running around. But some of the stories, there was a massacre by the Mau Mau against their own village, their own people. They had about 250 they killed in one night, burnt the whole. They're not very good at all.
Mm. So it's this strange, horrible backdrop to this beautiful country and a wonderful life.
Yes. Oh dear, dear, dear! It's shocking.
Mm. So how long were you in Kenya?
I went twice. I went in 1954.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just trying to think of when I went to Uganda. I went to Uganda, but...
It was after your first tour of Kenya, was it?
I'm just thinking... Oh, now I've got it, yes. Oh, no, yes. I did my tour of Kenya. And we used to go on parties there. At night, we go 200 miles, well, 200 miles is nothing here, but 200 miles in the wilds is a long way. Mm-hmm. And we used to go, I used to go down from, at a holiday camp, you know, Nile Beach. I don't know if you haven't been to Kenya.
No.
Nile Beach is a wonderful beach there, white beach. And we had a leave centre there. Mm-hmm. You carry off with your stuff in the car, boot. By the time you got there, you're on Murram roads. And they were corrugated like this. So you'd be vibrating. You go so fast over the ruts. But when you got down to Nairobi, to Mombasa, you would take the stuff out of the suitcase. And it was all thick dust and dirt. Black, you know, brown. Oh, there's a lot of funny things there. We've once been on the big dhows. You know these big dhows with the... hundreds of years old, some of them.
Mm.
Massive things they were. Well, they bring the carpets and the sugar in from overseas.
So, how did you come to leave Kenya then?
Well, I'm just trying to think this out. I had a very nice time there, the first time there, with the King's African Rifles. Oh, yes, I had to come back to the depot, yes.
Mm-hmm.
For Amalgamate, about 1957, 1958. I came back to the regimental depot when we were doing another amalgamation.
Which was where? In
Devizes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And what was this amalgamation?
Well, this was now the the Berkshire Regiment, and the words were Duke of Edinburgh's Royal Regiment, it became.
Right.
Which was the Royal Berkshire Regiment and the Wiltshire Regiment.
So you came back to Devizes after 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, I was the quartermaster there. We were doing training. We still had the Yes, we quite a few. National, what do you call it?
National service.
National service. Right. Oh, we had some good there. Well, they turned them out very quickly there. We had some good instructors too.
Did that change life in a regiment at all, having the national servicemen? Because they must have had a different attitude to some extent.
No, they came the same. Once they put the cap badge on, once they had the training like that, they were all the same. They were some wonderful people. Many, many of them I tried to persuade to stay on because they were so good. And many I met later who said, oh, I wish they had. But, I mean, they were all, once they were in, they wanted to get out. And then in the groups, they would talk each other into it. It's very difficult to get someone to stay on. And yet they wanted, a lot of them wanted to.
Yes, it wasn't the thing to do, was it?
That's the trouble, you see. I mean, it's like being a... not. It's like I noticed these days, if you don't drink, they think there's something wrong with you or something. If you don't get paralytic drunk or something. We had some wonderful people come in, join the... Well, all the way through.
So you were there in Devizes then, with Duke Benborough's Royal Regiment, for how long?
I had a very nice quarter there. The quarter was a very old, big building. Oh, it's cold though. I had the boiler was three rooms away. The boiler was, the water tank and the boiler was up the top of the... four stories up, five rooms along, and I was paying for the pipes, you know, the heating of the water was ridiculous. I tried to fight it. I won the battle in the end, but it took me 18 months to win. I had to do a lot of fighting there.
Were there often disputes about, you know, the costs of quarters and the quality of quarters and things? Was that just a big issue?
No. Well, don't forget, some of these were this return of the century ones. No, of that century. They were going back to 18-something. So you can imagine a school-like place. And you have a bathroom, two rooms over there, along the... I mean, it's so ridiculous. You cannot believe it. Not only the pipes running down so much, but running along as well and lagged. Oh, dear, dear, dear. Oh, dear, I had to fight a lot there. Oh, yes.
So how long did you stay at Devizes that time? Because you went to Uganda after that.
Yeah, I went back to Nairobi, actually.
Right.
On another job to start with. Mm. I'm just trying to work out when it was. I wasn't long. Mm. I went back to a place called Kahawa. Kahawa, K-A-H-A-W-A. It was a very, very big stores depot.
Sorry, what depot?
Stores depot.
Stores depot, yeah. Uh-huh. And you were working...
And there was a brigade, attached to us. I was the camp... I was called the Camp Commandant's Department.
Your duties there?
Well, I was a quartermaster of the place, and then I started I started learning the language. Swahili. Mm-hmm. I picked up some Swahili, but then I found towards the end of my time that the officers in the units, not many officers learned the language properly. I'm talking about properly, as opposed to pidgin English. So I was a bit too old to do it, but I attended evening classes in Nairobi with a very good professor, through the army, with the aim to getting a language qualification because I'm paying money for it, which I thought was a good thing. But that was two things. One, there was some money in it, and the other was I was ashamed to think that so many officers in a unit couldn't speak the language properly. I found that only two. So I studied one season and a lot at night. I mean, all the time. And I was talking to the staff all the time. So really, I got down to it properly. And I did it. It was the civil servants examination as opposed to the army one. And, I had such a very good professor that he could tell me. I was about to take the test, which was a government one where they had the top civil servants come down, a top civil servant and an African to do the testing. And this professor was so clever, he said, "Now, it's all straightforward," he said. "Think of what they can ask you on your examination. What can they ask you? Where do you come from? When do you go on leave? Are you married? All sorts of things like that." And I thought, well, that's good. And the more I thought about it, the more I went prepared to answer questions, which I could beat them to it. And I did. When I had to do the verbal, the African obviously was pretty good. And he was so quick, he'd ask me a question, and then he'd say yes, and I would answer him, and he'd say yes before I finished. And he did this so quickly that I said, "Look, he's messing me around, he's trying to..." Then I learnt later what he was saying to me was, "Nam," which is, "I understand, carry on." But he was deliberately doing that for me to talk more quickly. But what he didn't know, that I'd already geared up to tell him how I was going on leave to Mombasa. I was going by car. I would be passing so many places, the names of the places. I'd be seeing so many animals. And really, I really worked him a fast one because I passed that all right. But on the written, which I missed the written by about 5 points, and I reckon they should have given me that. And I didn't really... I was doing all this extra, learning all this on top of my job. So really, I didn't really have the time to spend doing it afterwards. But I was so pleased, and it's on my record, that not many people have done that. Mm. So at least I achieved something.
Yeah. So how long did you stay there at the stores department?
Well, I was called up to go after about 9 months. Uh-huh. I was then called to New Uganda.
So what did you know about Uganda and what you were going to do?
All I knew about was it's about to become independent, mm-hmm. and I arrived 2 days after their independence.
And what year was that?
Now that's a tricky one, that. I've got to think this backwards. I'm not quite sure now. My mind is not quite...
Never mind, that doesn't matter. What was your impression of Uganda when you arrived there? You went to Kampala, didn't you?
Yeah. No, I didn't. I went to a place called Jinja. Don't forget, I've been travelling around the country a lot. I travelled to Uganda many times.
Right.
Well, a few times.
Yes.
On holiday.
Right. So
yes.
Entirely new to you.
No.
What were you going to be doing? Were you joining a regiment?
Well, I was the quartermaster of that battalion. There was only one. There
was
only one battalion. It was the 4th Battalion, the King's African Rifles.
Right.
This was very interesting. They were also operating up country, up to the mountains of the moon. And I was travelling many places. But after settling in there, we had a big parade, independence parade. And I was then fortunate that I was doing all the things, because they became independent. I was then, as a quartermaster, allowed to do things which I always wanted to do. The Africans' soldiers had compo rations, which is composite rations, but they were not they were British Army compo rations, which they were could have, which was no good. I mean, they didn't like them.
So it was literally the same rations as any British soldier would
have. For compo rations, which is ridiculous for the troop. So I was fortunate and able to have... I had the money. I didn't have the money physically, but I had the means of using the money. So I then you've got the local Indian to produce exactly the same sort of thing for Africans. And I've got a team of three. There were three warrant officers, army. They were about to be promoted soon. They soon became officers, African. And we sorted out how much sugar. I went through the ration scale and gave them exactly what they would like. And I got the doctor to check it. You see, part of their staple diet was groundnuts. Well, as soon as the British troops arrived in Kenya, they started calling them monkey nuts. So as soon as the African troops heard them being called monkey nuts, they wouldn't touch them. So it was a bit tricky. So in the end, I'd get a 3-ton load of monkey nuts, take them to the local British unit, switch them for pineapple, tins of pineapple, bring it back for the Africans. So it worked very well.
So they would eat tins of pineapple, would they?
Oh yes. Anything we eat. Yeah. But I was able to give them everything in a pack which they wanted. To me, and I was able to do it for half the price. Each soda cost half the price of what it would cost if I bought it through the British trade. At the same time, I had a chance of changing many of the administrative things. Of each man, each African, had a bar of soap. So instead of their sheets being handed in and being laundered, we allowed them, give them extra soap, and they would wash their own sheets. Saved a lot of work of counting. Now, all sorts of tin, I gave each man a tin box, a lockable tin box, so when he went away, he could lock his staff up. There was about six things I did, which I always wanted to do when I was in the British Army, but didn't have the authority to do. And then a wonderful thing happened one afternoon. This was Independence, and I had a call from the government, an African in the government, who said to me, how much would it cost to form two more battalions? This was one battalion, there was two battalions. He said, I want to know by 5 o'clock. Yeah, you can imagine. I couldn't tell anyone else at the headquarters. We had a headquarters of which we had a staff officer from the UK who didn't know anything about African troops. So I couldn't tell anyone there that I had to do this job. But I was able to do it, and I'm so proud to be able to say that I was able to do it, and I was there 12 months later to make sure it worked.
And that was two new regiments?
Two new regiments, and that means I gave the cost of everything.
Yeah.
Within 2 hours. And the way I did it, I took 100 men, I thought, I'd taken 100 men. I knew how much everything a man, it would cost, a hat, everything, boots, I knew automatically how much it cost. So all I had to do was get the equipment for one man, multiplied by 1,000, for 1,000 men. I've worked out how many it's going to be. Now, the only thing couldn't do was things like pay. I couldn't do pay. Petrol I could estimate. Ammunition I could estimate, because they were using ammunition. But I was able to get the figure. And vehicles, it was secret. I knew that I could give them 25 vehicles.
Yeah.
And anyone knows how much one bivocal costs.
Yes.
So I was able to produce that.
It went through at 5 o'clock,
and then I had a rut. Well, I got over it, because the Africans were the people who said that I was the man who would produce the answer. Had I done it, the British Army would have taken 6 years, 6 months. Mm. 6 months. I know that, because I've tried to do it.
Excellent. Arthur Caney, end of Reel 12.